Okay, we're Perek Gimel Pasuk Chet. And this chapter is taking a turn. The end of Habakkuk is about the fall of Babel. The book began with this prophet speaking with great arrogance and chutzpah against God allowing the Babylonians to succeed as much as they had. God, I trust. I'm a prophet. I speak to you. You speak to me. And I know you're behind what's going on in the world. How did you allow the Babylonians to reach such heights and such arrogance? If you recall the first few psukim of this book, hardly anyone in the Tanakh who speaks with the chutzpah straight to God's face as much as this Habakkuk. Right? Rashi said that's why he began this chapter with the words Al Shigyonot. Because he said, God, I must have been meshuggah when I was talking to you that way. Right? Okay. Now, we talked already in the last class, in the class before that, of other biblical characters who spoke with such chutzpah to God. Right? Not least of which Abraham, who says, HaShokhi kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, shall the judge of the entire land not pursue justice? How can you act so unjustly throughout history? Last night we had a Yom HaShoah event at my shul, and we had a 77-year-old man, I could imagine he's very young, who survived Auschwitz. And, you know, he was five when he got to Auschwitz. Five-year-olds were taken within the hour of getting off the train straight to the gas chambers. How did he survive Auschwitz? The answer is, he was a twin. And the head medical doctor of Auschwitz, named Yosef Mengele, was obsessed with twins. So, if anyone came in and they was convinced that they were twins, they both said, he and his sister both survived. 2 5-year-old twins, off the train in Auschwitz, were given special treatment. Of course, he was obsessed with them because he performed medical experiments on them. So, he usually did it on one of them and not on the other. So he was lucky for him. He was the one that was the control. His sister was the operating on at five. And you see the two of them today. She suffers from multiple sclerosis, and she's confined to a wheelchair for the last 20 years. And he's a vibrant, tall man. She's certainly with her wits, but she's not capable of moving around. He is... And he spoke last night at my shul. We had a dialogue together, and he's very cheerful, very friendly, very open about his experiences, and he tells about what it was like to actually see Mengele face to face. And we took questions from the audience afterwards, and once some person said, did you ever think while you were there, where was God? And he said, I was 5 years old. I was just thinking of what's the next meal. Right? So there's a 5-year-old now. I didn't know what the world has in store for us. You know, he was at Theresienstadt, he was 3. I don't know what kids are supposed to do when they grow up. But so I just know that from the time that I was liberated from Auschwitz on that death march, it took him 4 years to find out that his sister survived also. Ironically, the Russians made a film about all the children being watched out of Auschwitz, showing off their numbers and their arms, a famous film. But both of them are in the same film, just 10 seconds apart. Know that, you know, she was behind him being carried by a woman, and he was walking ahead, and then they got separated, but then through amazing, miraculous events, they were reunited in America in 1949. The question he's asking is, just transfer Bovel to Germany, and transfer Habakkuk. Said, I've only had the greatest hatzlocha from the time that after that death march, I was taken to an orphanage, and someone took an interest in me, and he took me home, and he gave me an upbringing, incredibly, his sister was a topic of a story in Life magazine in 1947, and the person who took him in Czechoslovakia saw the last name of this little girl who was adopted in America, so it was the same name that he had, and it was the same age, and we figured that must be his twin. And he
Conference of America where they were reading it. So, which was, again, 65 years ago. So he said, he's describing his experiences. What do you know? Today everyone is finding fault with everything that happened to us. And Habakkuk lays it thick on God. Right? People hear it for the first time. He's so thick. Open up the statement and see the first few seconds and say for Habakkuk. And you'll be amazed. What a human being. What chutzpah do you have to talk to God this way? You're here on earth for a short time. Tomorrow you're going to be food for worms, and you dare talk to God this way? Right? He says, I'll tell you why no one believes in you, and no one studies your Torah, because you allow all these trespasses and all these... Right? And God just, allows him to talk this way. But at the end of the book, he says, you know what, I see now in retrospect, I was wrong in talking this way. He was given a prophecy of the fall of the Bavel. Right? When did the war turn against Germany? Already in 41, the war. Any military strategist can see that the war has already turned. So anyone but the megalomaniac that there was would have realized at that time to just slow down. He was all in, all to the very end. So during that time, where he badly needed armaments and supplies for soldiers, he was busy using cattle cars all over Europe to take more and more Jews to their immediate death. So people look back at this and say, God, where were you all this time? Which is again how Habakkuk begins. But if someone starts to see, I can see what's changing here. I can see that the tide has turned. Now we just have to hold out and see if we can survive this thing. Recently, I think it was just a week ago, it was right before Pesach, Dr. Jeff Gurak, a historian here at the school, gave a lecture, what would have happened if the Jews in America, if there was no Holocaust? What would Jewry in America, what would it look like in the year 2015?
Non-existent.
If there was no Holocaust?
It's about the book.
What?
It's about his book.
Yeah, it's a book. Right?
Judaism would have been extinct.
Yeah, well, those were certainly the predictions made in 1940 and 1950. So I'm not looking at any silver lining here. I'm just trying to figure out what Habakkuk is doing here in chapter 3, after the way he begins his book with such chutzpah, condemning God for what he is allowing to happen in the world. That allowance, you should just know historically, is that the Babylonians, by the word of Yirmiyahu, for goodness sakes, by the exhortation of prophets who predicted such things, like Tzfania and Yirmiyahu, that the Babylonians ran over the whole world. And if we can compare what the Babylonians did in their time to what the Assyrians had done 150 years earlier, right? I think I told you, maybe it was from my Yishayahu class, that the Assyrians, although before the Babylonians, left us a much more archaeological material than the Babylonians. The Babylonians have left us hardly anything. We know very little about the Babylonian period. We know a lot more about the Assyrians, even though it's earlier, for the very simple reason. The Assyrian period lasted much longer. The Assyrians ruled the world they ruled for almost 130 years. The Babylonians came and went in a wisp.
They were Chaldeans.
Right, because by the time they reached their great heights, the Persians were already ready to take over. Right? It didn't last so long. So they didn't leave us so much material. Right? So let me just compare something, especially if you just took a class in Yishayahu. Do you remember in chapter 9 and 10 of Yishayahu, that prophet refers to the arrogance of the Assyrians in taking all the credit for what's happening in the world, and I don't know why the prophet should think they should consider otherwise, but they didn't see their position as part of a larger plan. They just said, we're running the world. Our God has destroyed the God of Israel as well as the gods of the other nations. Right? And for that arrogance, for the man who said, I will climb to the heavens and take over the stars and destroy everything here on earth, to be part of my kingdom. So the Gemara compares that to the way Nimrod behaves. crash down your tall towers, which is why Yeshayahu in chapter 9 and 10 uses such imagery of the letter destruction of Baga, Migdal Baga. And remember we at the time we compared it to Parshas Ha'azinu? Luchach mu yavinu zos, if only the nations were smart, they would understand how they came to such power and what they... Okay, so what Yeshayahu does in chapter 9 and 10 with regards to Assyria, Habakkuk is doing in chapter 3 with regards to Baal. Now let's go look at that introduction. Let's open the text. Again, what Yeshayahu does in chapter 9 and 10. And very often in history, if you're a good historian, you'll know that what took nations down was their arrogance about their power. Sometimes a world history can change over one small battle, but in one way or another, not so much because of the amount of soldiers or the armaments, but because of sheer arrogance. I think I told you about, you know, think of how this world would be different if the British quelled the independence movement of this country, and there was never a declaration of independence, there was never a successful war for the colonies, and England continued to rule over this part of the world.
They would have peaked a lot quicker, and they would have gone down a lot quicker.
So we have to figure out what you know, how the world would have changed, but...
I mean, American identity would have developed anyway. You just later.
Britain rises, Britain collapses. It can't support its colonies anymore, and America has started anyway.
Okay, it could be later. It could be. There was probably destined to be some kind of war or fight over slavery, as it happened in England. Yes.
How do you feel that the American Revolution was impacted upon the African, you know, self? Rule. I mean, really, that was
Everyone has to put all this into the mix. Plus, the German ascendance in the 19th century towards militarism, and all this has to go in the mix. There are books called "What If." But the reason I'm telling you all this is because the General George Cornwallis was considered by historians to be the greatest military mind of all time. Maybe with the exception of Yehoshua, who has a statue in front of West Point where it says the greatest military mind of all time. It says Joshua. Anyway, he was an arrogant SOB. He was such a despicable.
Cornwallis, well, he lost one battle.
Okay, but he was arrogant. You could say he had the right to be arrogant. He was the best there ever was, right? He was his arrogance, some historians claim, they point to particular events. His foolish arrogance is what may have turned the tide of the revolution. And then you have to start asking, so how different could history have been because of the arrogance? That is what Yeshayahu is doing in chapter 9 and 10, and that, again, that is what Habakkuk is doing in chapter 3. Bavel's arrogance and Asher's arrogance led to their downfall. It was Israel's immorality that led to them becoming so powerful in the first place. All right? Now the prophets always turned to Israel and said, okay, please be moral. Learn the lessons of history. And these things won't keep happening. Pasuk Ches. Havin harim chara Hashem, im ban harim apecha, im bayam evrasecha, kisir kaval susecha, markabosecha Yeshua. So he's looking now at nature, which Perigimel Pasuk Ches in Habakkuk. He's looking at nature, right? Will you think God gets angry with nature at the rivers? In Bayom Evrasecha Kitir Kaval Susecha Markavosecha Yeshua. Do you think that you? That your salvation came from your chariots and from your what's the nature that the Babylonians, like the Assyrians,
the prophets often refer to the Nahar Prat, the Euphrates, which watered over all the crops of the of this part of the world the same way that the Nile did for the Egyptians. And both nations, Ashur and Mitzrayim, considered this natural connection they had to be a further proof of the favor of the gods. Yirmiyahu bunches these two together in chapter 2 by saying, by putting the Egyptians with their Meshichor and the Babylonians, in that case the Assyrians, with their main Nahar, God will punch you all together and the world fall. So do you think that you have the favor of a divine favor because of all these things? And you think that it's your might and your chariots that brought you to this position? Nonsense. Now, of course, this is the Hebrew prophet saying this in retrospect, that Babylonian might is not a function of their chariots. It's a function of the rod of God's wrath to teach his immoral nation a lesson. You think the Babylonians are going to get that? I wouldn't expect them to. Right? But the prophet still says, Eriote or Kashtecha, Shvuos Matos Omer Sef. Difficult Hebrew. Naros Kaka Oretz. If the Shigur HaKatuv, right? Eriote or Kashtecha, Shvuos Matos Omer Sef. The point the Pasuk is making is that I will strip bare. You see the word area, like Erva? I will strip your power naked. Power is not in your bows and arrows. Okay? Shvos Matos Omer Sela. So, Shvos Shenishbato, the oaths that you took, right, that you thought would be everlasting. The Nazis thought that their Reich would last 1,000 years. Remember? They thought that their society would last for 1,000 years. They were going to take care of the Jews first, and you know what was coming next? Christianity. Right?
Is it because they believed that in order to have a perfect socialistic world?
Which was supposed to be paganistic.
Oh, they're pagan.
Absolutely. No.
There'd be no
room for. There's room maybe for a divine power of sorts.
No, but they worship.
But not
the power
anyone.
Of God.
Not anyone.
Part of God.
No, they knew that they needed Christianity at first. But their point was that you should not be bound to the struggle of guilt. Mein Kampf is the struggle that the Jews and Christians put on the world of their guilt. What you should do is just isolate what you need to do best for society. Right? Look at all the things that are hampering that and get rid of it. Which are the weak, retarded people, gypsies, or anyone like that, get rid of them. We'll set up the prophets just started with music, art, science, and then they felt no guilt at any of this. This is why they were, you know, able to in such a short time, relatively short time, 6-7 years, convince people that it's okay to throw babies live into the fire. We're doing the world a favor. When this is all, when the dust settles on this war, we're going to set in a perfect society. In the meantime, we're going to have to be very strict with anyone who disobeys, right? Okay. All right. So that is the keshes, the shvuos matos that this pasuk is referring to. I'd like to point out naharos tvakaoritz, and it means that basically how I would like to explain the last few verses, the few words of this pasuk is that the body of water with which you claim such strength. Call that the Euphrates, right? The Nahar Prat. Tivaka Oretz. That body of water itself can undo the land. In other words, I'll send one tsunami and it'll sweep you all away. Tivaka Oretz is this. Usually Tivaka describes, that's what describes Kriyas Yamsu, that's Tivaka Hayah. Tibakahoretz means it will chop up your land. Snap all your trees away. I'm not pointing to any particular event in history. There are other prophets who specifically refer to water coming from a body and sweeping away land with it back into the world. Amos refers to such a thing after an earthquake. Let's talk about that. It's phenomenal. The water rushes in at something like 600 miles an hour and goes as far as it'll go, and then it goes back to the water, takes everything back with it. This might be what he's talking about, the phrase with which you take such great pride will be the very thing that breaks up the land. Pasuk Yud, everyone together, Ra'ucha, you got it? Ra'ucha yachilu harim, zerem mayim avar, masan tzahom kolob, rom yodeh nasah. It's a very difficult psukim. The Hebrew is difficult, but this basically just continues the same thought. Right? The mountains will cause your feet to tremble. There'll be a steady stream of water over you that will do the same. Right? The depths will give their will call out. Right? And from the depths they will come out to grab you. This can refer to an earthquake. Right? You know that there is a direct fault line straight up Israel, all the way up through Bava. There have been a lot of devastating earthquakes in Iran in the last number of years. Right? There was one that just leveled a whole town. Qom, Q-O-M. It killed 60,000 people in a split second. Back in, I think, the 80s.
Is that because it wasn't foundation, wasn't
right there? It was built on sand.
Like if that same earthquake were to happen in California,
There have been some earthquakes like that.
Right, but now everything is built earthquake roof and like the whole way.
Yeah, depends what kind of earthquake, but yeah. Okay. All right, so basically, what just to review these three psukim. What was he just saying? You and your arrogance, Bavel. Yes, you're the most powerful nation probably that ever existed until now. Probably so, even more than Assyria. But your arrogance is so profound it can be taken down in a second. And I have many things God says in his arsenal to take it down so quickly. Right? Shemesh yareach amad zvula l'or chitzecha yalechu l'noga barak chanisecha. Right? Even the heavenly bodies will stand up against you. Okay? Shemesh v'yareach amad zvula means lizvul. So, Targum says that this refers to Mamad Har Sinai and the nations refusing to accept God and Yahushua holding the sun up in the sky. What's Targum doing? Targum is saying that I'm going to give irrefutable events. Irrefutable events will take place where the Babylonians won't be able to continue with their charade much longer. People will see what so quickly will happen to Babel that they'll realize, oh, this is not just the twists and turns of history. Right? Back to Hazim, Luchachmu Yabinuzos. If they're only wise enough or moral enough, they'd see it themselves. As clear as the sun is in the sky with the moon, l'or chitzecha yalechu l'noga barak chanisecha. According to Rashi, the end of his pasuk is talking about Bnei Yisrael. L'or chitzecha yalechu talks about Israel. L'noga barak chanisecha. Is that through... The end of the pasuk Yud Aleph is pointing out that Babylonia's rise to prominence and their phenomenal growth in world domination is meant to be a light unto Israel. Explain that to me. It's meant to be a message for you. Yeah? If you continue in your immoral path without anyone to show you the destructive ways, destructive nature of your ways, you're worse off. Babylonians did you a favor. They exiled you just when it was necessary to do so. I find this point that Habakkuk is making in a drash.
It's a famous drash that Rashi makes. You know, the first pasuk in the Torah reading of Tisha B'Av, it says, when I take you to the land, v'no shantem shom, and you remain there for a long time, and you remain there so long that you sin, and I send you into exile as a result. That's why it's a Torah reading of Tisha B'Av. Right? Remember what Rashi does with this word? Tell me the Gematria. 2 bugs is 12. This is 350. This is 440. What are we doing here? Got it? 852. How many years were we in Israel? Can you figure out quickly? Any benchmarks? First base semester stood 410 years. It was 480 years from the time we left Egypt to the time of the building of the base semester. Right? How many years from the time we left Egypt was it before we got to Israel?
40.
So you're familiar with what Rashi does with this? Isn't that amazing? It says, "Benoshantem," and you remain in Israel until I cast you out. It's amazingly close to the amount of time we spent in Israel before getting cast out. The Rashi says, had we remained 2 more years in Israel, we would have become so sinful that we never would. What do I mean? Think of the following metaphor. I might have used it in another context in this class, but remember the first time you got your car keys? To drive? What happened there? Okay, at a certain age, someone's going to give you the keys to the car and say, okay, you can go out with your friends, you can have the car just for a few hours, and they give you some rules. You want to tell me some of those rules? I remember the first time I did. I have a car. Be home by a certain hour.
Don't try speed. Give yourself space. Your phones, I mean.
Yeah, don't text me. Don't mind driving.
Don't crash your car.
Okay, true.
Be safe.
Obey the traffic signs. Yeah. Maybe even the passengers, but there was only usually supposed to be a limit to passengers.
Yeah.
Studies show that when you put too many friends in the car, you tend to do things that are a little more dangerous. So, you know, you tend to try to be, get some rowdy in the car, no drinking. You make all the rules, no more than two or three other people in the car, right? Okay, so the curfew was 11 p.m., and the kid shows up at 2 a.m., car swerves into the driveway. He stumbles out of the car, and it's clearly he's like stumbling into the house. 6 kids get out of the car! He's his way upstairs. He's open his door. He's into bed. On Sunday morning, his father comes in and says, "Oh, son, what time did you get home?" He said, "Dad, it was about 11:15, 11:10. I'm sorry, we got into this traffic, we got stuck on the highway on the way home, and I saw when I got home that everyone was sleeping, so I just, you know." That's what Yirmiyahu calls Meshuvah Nitzachas. He's rebellious, he didn't follow the rules, he got away with it, right? So the father says to him, "Son, you don't think I waited up for you? I saw when you came home, and I saw how you came home. I didn't want to confront you on the spot. Did you get a good night's sleep? Okay, just, you know what? I remember the first time I got the car also. You made a mistake. You got caught. Next time you give. That kid's going to school. He says, my father's the coolest dude on my line. He understands me. He's such a cool guy." Right? Now, fast back and talk about his father who says, "Son, you see these car keys?
you are not getting even a glimpse of them for the next 6 months, and you're grounded in this room after school for 3 months. You're not going anywhere. What's going on?
But it's a different avenue, you're saying.
So, the father who rebukes it this way, when he gets to school on Monday morning, he's telling all his friends, my father is, he doesn't understand me, he's such a nerd, he's, he comes from a different world, right? You know what's going to happen to that first kid the second time he gets the car? He's going to blow a stop sign and kill everybody in the car. Alright, the car is the land of Israel, the car is the kingdom. The life is the people of Israel. The father says, I have to take away the car. I have to, because if I keep letting you drive the way you disobey, right? Now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu always leaves the door open a little bit. He leaves it open a crack for us. So that excellent tshuva is always a chance to change your zera. But Hashem says, listen, I cannot let you continue in the land of Israel 2 more years. Because if you continue with the way you are now, it will be, you will go too far and you will not be able to come back.
Is everyone exiled?
So I'm doing you a favor. Well, you see, if...
Okay,
I'm so... Alright, so he says that too much time has passed, and I need you to take a powder, right? Right. That is what Rashi says, that this is a message to shed light for Bnei Israel. Okay? Right. Back to Baba. Bizam titz'ad oretz va'af tadush koyim. Yotzosa li'esha amecha, li'esha es mishichecha, machatz the rosh b'beis rasha, baros yisod ad tzabor sel. Guys, we haven't seen anything like this in our semester. Nothing like this. This is a very difficult Hebrew. Remember, this is the Haftorah, the second day of Shavuos. Right? Okay. In anger, Bizam titz'ad oretz ba'av tadush goyim. According to Rashi, actually, this is going back on the Jews. I gave you the opportunity to trample upon other nations. When was that? When you entered the land of Canaan, right? I strengthened you. I gave Yahushua that great strength to take over this land. And you came to great salvation, say for Yahushua, right? And you took over the land. And you had great saviors. You had Gidon, and you had Shimshon, and you had Yiftoth, and you had... You had Baruch and Aminoam and Devorah and great leaders. David and Shlomo, what did you do? Machatz the Rosh Mibes Rosha, Aros Yisod Atzavar Sela. And you were able to wipe out, to smite the heads from the house of the wicked, and you uncovered the foundation all the way up to the shoulders of those who you stood against. More about their, about what you were able to do. Gedalit no kafta b'matov rosh prozov yis'arulach yitzeni. Alit suvsam kimo le'echol ani b'mistar. Very difficult Hebrew. Right? Prozov. That's the, if we can figure out what that word means, we can figure out what this passage is. Prozov. Mazet proz. Proz. Prozim. Have you heard the word? Orei ha-prozim. We know that's the word of it. Al-Kain, therefore the people who live in Aray Prazim shall observe this holiday on the 14th. What?
Long space.
Exactly. Long
space, not long space.
Right. Aray Mitzarot are walled cities. Aray Prazim means unwalled cities. Chadal Prazon be Israel, complains Devorah. We can no longer have open cities. We have to wall them because we are so afraid of the enemy. Okay. So, okay. Now, Kavtav Matav Rosh Prazov. When you come to a land where all the cities are walled, is that a protected place or a weak place? What do you think? It's some of both. Obviously, the wall protects you. Well, I'll phrase the question as follows.
It's protected.
Who feels safer at night? Someone who leaves his door open or someone who has 12 locks? What neighborhood seems safer? Neighborhoods where there are police driving all over the place all night, every 30 seconds there's a police car driving down, or a neighborhood where they get one stroll through the neighborhood once a night. Alright? So the city that needs all the locks is the walled city, right? The city that where the police have to drive by every 2 or 3 minutes is the walled city. That's exactly interesting. Rashi writes this in Parsha Shlach, when Moshe sends the scouts into Israel, and he says, tell me in b'mivtzarim, in b'machanim. Tell me if the cities are fortified or if they're walled. And Rashi writes, I have a mesorah, the ordained, that if you see the walled cities when you get to Canaan, that's a sign that there are easy pickets. That there are bread. We'll easily conquer them. Right? If they have walled cities in Israel, they feel weak, and that means that we can easily take over. Right? Got it? Look how they psyched themselves out. When they came back, you remember the message that the Maharam gave to Moshe? He said, we can't conquer this land. It's filled with walled cities. What? That's what I was trying to tell you. If you see a lot of walled cities, that means they don't feel secure. Alright? Got it? So now let's figure out what this is saying. Now it makes sense. You came in and you trampled on 31 nations. I strengthened you so much to get you started in these for 850 years. You started off with so miraculously. Who would have thought that these former slaves could take over 31 nations? Right? The 31 kings out of the 7 nations of Canaan. Right? And what did you do? You took the best of their prazim. You get it? This is telling the truth, not the way the Meraglim said it. They had open cities that were much better protected than those fortified cities. And you were able to take all of them. Right? And you were able to describe a certain metaphor, which I guess is interesting. Just yesterday, I was just telling you about that Yom HaShoah program. He described what the death march from the camp. It's only 45, so he was 7, not yet 8. And he described the death march, and that all of a sudden they noticed that there are no Germans on their side. Because why are we still marching? The Germans just disappeared. Because they saw Russians. And the Russians quickly surrounded them and took them all to a warehouse where there was food. Right? You could imagine these people were starved for so long, rushed, and trampled over each other to get the food. And he was describing how he sees all these boots, because he's down here, everyone, you know, he's a 7-year-old, malnourished to be sure. Although the twins did get some special treatment, a little bit, but and he's watching all the people rush to get the food. Like the Haftorah of Parshas Metzora, where they left the gates to see all the food, and they trampled upon the person who opened it and killed him on the way to get the food. But you can imagine what that trampling is like when people are starved to get food, right? So he says, "Kimole echol oni b'mistar," like a poor person who rushes to get a little food that all of a sudden gets opened up to him. That was until then hidden. I mean, often the poor people never who rush to get that food, they eat too much and that kills them. Right? You hear those terrible stories after the war, the soldiers came in and so they threw them chocolate and coffee, you know, the kind of food that they had, and then it burst their stomachs. Right? When Yosef took his family after to Egypt, right, it says he gave lechem lefi hataf. He gave bread by ration. Each family got according to the amount of chocolate. So Sforno says, why did you give so little bread? You should just be generous with the bread you give. Right? You're the leader here. You can give as much as you want. And Sforno said, be careful. These people have been starving for 2 years. If you give them too much, their stomachs will burst. Right? So this bunny who comes in from impoverished treatment for a few years, right? So it says, Alitsu Sam, their joy and their excitement will be like a poor person who's been starving for years who's looking at a banquet. Right? Right? That's the way you were in it was like taking candy from a baby. That could be awful. You have a smorgasbord of food for purple. That's the way you were when you came to Canaan. Everything was easy pickings for you. You didn't have to work for anything. You know what's amazing about that? I don't know if you can feel it. Do you ever know what Rashi does in Parshas Ha'azinu? Takes about 20 psukim and he translates it as referring to the nations. And then afterwards he says, we have a tradition that all these 20 psukim can relate also to the Israel. And he goes on, he does the last half of Parshat Zinu again. That's what can be done here. These psukim, Rashi's derech is that these psukim are talking about the Jews and their success in the conquest of Canaan so many years ago, right? Okay. But we can also explain this as the success of Bavel in trampling over the world now. Right? We have to see how the book is going to end. We have just a few more psukim. Get in, come on. Pasuk Tet Zayin. Shamati batir gaz bitzvi v'kol tzolus osai yavo barakot ba'atzamay v'sachtay v'goz. Now this is Habakkuk talking himself. I have heard and I have butterflies in my stomach. My stomach is getting sick over the voices that I hear, the noise that I hear, right? The screams that I hear, right? Yavo rakov batzamay v'tachtay ergoz. Rakov batzamay is that which eats away at your marrow, right? Ergoz, same word, roges, that causes me fear and trembling. I'm leaving it aside for a bad day. Right? What Pasuk Tetzayin is talking about is that Habakkuk is still, when all is said and done, for all his prophecies of what's going to happen to Bavel, and the ingracious nature of Bnei Yisrael for not being thankful to Hashem for all these successes that they had when they came to Israel, he's saying that when all is said and done, I still have this terrible feeling in my gut because Israel is still facing this fact of Bavel's conquest. Right? It's a Yom Tzara when all is said and done. Right? There's a nation, Yigudenu, right? Like God, Gedud, Yigudenu. There's a nation that's still fortified against us. Ki te'ena lo tifrach ve'en yavul begafonim. Now we're getting back to what's happening in Israel. Yirmiyahu also said that during the time of the Babylonian destruction, they destroyed so much of our agriculture that nothing grew for 70 years. Even animals had no food. Ki te'ena lo tifrach. Figs will not grow. Ve'en yavul begafonim. No vineyards produce grapes. Ki chesh ma'aseh zayis. The olives have defied us. Ushdemos lo asa ochel. No field produces food. Gazar mimichlatzon ve'en bakor barfasim. All of the sheep have died. There are no cattle in the stalls. Wow. Here's an important point. Crucial point. The Babylonians were to serve a certain purpose, to take away the car keys from Bnei Yisrael. You all get that metaphor I said before, right? Yeah. Okay. because I want you to drive again one day. And if you go 6 months, 70 years, without driving, the car I'll give you afterwards will be much better. Assuming that you can follow the rules then. Right? Learn your lesson, learn it well. Learn the rules of the road, learn to follow directions, the directions are my Torah, and you will succeed much to a much greater extent. Bavel is just my, the rod of my wrath to make sure that you follow those rules. Got it? Yirmiyahu at one point predicted that Bavel will do this to you, and there's no walking back on it. You can't change that. Yirmiyahu walked around, and you see the te'inah here that doesn't produce? He walked around chapter 24 of Yirmiyahu, carried two baskets of figs. One beautiful figs that everyone wants to eat from, the other was so disgusting that you would throw up just looking at it. And the people would ask, why are you walking with these two different baskets of figs? What do they represent? And he said, this basket of good figs, these are the Jews who submit and surrender to the Babylonians. The bad figs, these are the Jews who put up a fight and make a stand for Jerusalem. And that was not a very popular motion at the time, right? It's about as popular now as the Naturi Karta, who beg Israel, please just let Iran take over the Knesset. Let Iran run Israel until Moshiach comes, and all will be better for us. If the Naturi Karta could, you all know who the Naturi Karta is, right? If they could actually make that happen, they would. Why do you think they're always going to Iran? And you think they give awards to the president of Iran, and they run programs there. It's insane. While Iran is having
like 400
denying Holocaust, they won.
Aren't there like 400 of them in the world?
Yeah, they, of course, but they get hyped up.
They
get hyped up in the news very much. But the point is,
they get the Jerusalem out of their tomorrow's rest.
I don't think so. The point is that Yirmiyahu demanding the people surrender to the Babylonians was not popular. The people themselves said, this is not Medrash, these are Pesukim and Yirmiyahu, the God who took us out of Egypt and humbled the Egyptian army when we didn't have an army could very easily destroy the Babylonians, who we admit are much stronger than we are right now on paper, right? Could destroy the Babylonians when we do have an army, right? We can outlast these Babylonians, don't worry. We outlasted the Assyrians, surely we can outlast the Babylonians. So Yirmiyahu says, well, technically you're right, but right now the keys are being taken away from you. You don't deserve it. Of course God can flip his finger and destroy the Babylonians, but he's not inclined to because of your awful, immoral behavior. Okay, you hear it? Right? So Yirmiyahu spends much of the rest of his book trying to beg the people to surrender to the Babylonians. And he says, if you surrender and let them just come in, they listen to this bargain. They will not kill your king, they will not destroy your temple, and they won't exile you. Just let them come in. And we know that they did not heed that call. Because they put up a valiant fight. The Babylonians did not take kindly to that. You know what Yirmiyahu was doing when the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem? Where was he? He was in jail. He was jailed by the king for daring to speak such seditious prophecies. Right? And while he was in jail, he was freed by the Babylonian general who came to destroy Jerusalem. He said, don't touch Yirmiyahu and any of his followers. They wanted to make peace with us. Even if the Iranians would be honorable, let's say, and when they come in and take over Israel, don't take this out of context, of course, would allow the Naturi Karta to have Me'esharim, right? Yeah? That would not be much of a comfort for the rest of us. Right? The Babylonians, where the Jews accused Yirmiyahu of even conspiring with the Babylonians to gain favor from them. He got the favor. They took him out of jail. Right? History records otherwise. That the point of Yirmiyahu's message was as follows. the car keys had to be taken away for a certain amount of time. That was supposed to be 70 years. What is Israel supposed to look like during those 70 years? If you had submitted to the Babylonians, they would have let you stay. And it would be time to come back after 70 years for the people who had already gone from the lost 10 tribes, or from 597 when they took off the main leaders with those Yehoiachin, right? Yechezkel, Daniel, Mordechai. That the Jews would have come back to a land that was inhabited. Babylonians even allowed Yirmiyahu to maintain a community. Remember, who did he hire? So, was his name? Didn't end up being a great favor. But he was the son of a man who had saved Yirmiyahu's life earlier in the book, chapter 26, when they wanted to kill him for saying that basically the troops would be destroyed. A man named Achikom ben Shafan saved his life. Who was his famous son? Achikom ben Shafan. Who was his famous son? Gedaliah ben Achikom, of course. Again, it didn't end up being a great favor because they killed him. And that was strike two. Because after they killed Gedaliah, the Babylonians carried off another thousands of remnants. And still they let Yirmiyahu stay with the community until they carried him off to Egypt, where he ostensibly died 6 months. Amazing. What would have happened if tens of thousands of Jews remained? Let me tell you a what-if question. If many Jews had remained in Israel, which was the plan, then when it came time to call 70 years later for Jews to come back, anyone want to take a quick stab at how many Jews followed? How many Jews came back? 42,360. The size of a small tribe 1,000 years earlier. 42,360. It's nothing. Right? But if Jews had been living there all along, things might have been different.
How many were there in total?
A few million. 42,360 is nothing. Right? Because two things were working against them. Things were so bad in Israel because of this, because everyone left. And things were so good for the Jews in Persia. Right? Artaxasta, Daryovish, Koresh, all the kings were so good to them. So life was like today. Life was so good in the Gulf. I shouldn't say that today, but let's put it this way. Do you know, could you picture what it's like, what it was like to make Aliyah in 1870? You familiar with stories? Clearing the marshes and everyone died of typhus and of cholera and of diseases. And right? There was no water, there was a desolate land. And what it's like to, let's say, make Aliyah in 1970. You had electricity, you had a government, you had, right? Yirmiyahu was hoping that the return to Israel would be to a fortified, growing nation, where vineyards had been tended all this time, where the figs and the olives and the vineyards are producing. But now, because everybody left, and you put up the fight against the Babylonians, none of this is there. So who's going to want to come? That has to be a practical reason for them to want to come. But life became so good in Persia, and so bad in Israel, that so few came. And all the promises made for the perfection of Bayis Sheni never happened. Because they didn't deserve it. They didn't come back. History could have been so different. When you're not tilling soil for 70 years and you come back, put a shovel to the ground, you know what you're hitting? Rock. I'm not talking about hard soil. You're hitting rock. Bani b'shem eloza. Agila be'elohe yishi. Hashem Adonai cheli ve'yosem raglai kayalos v'alba v'asai v'cheni v'amnatzeach v'niginosai. What a way to finish the book. He just takes a sharp turn. Right? Sharp turn out of nowhere. And he just says, but I'm going to sing a song to God. Because I know the truth. What a reversal. Just out of nowhere, he says, I will sing to God. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. He is my strength. He makes my feet run like gazelles.
Lamnatseach b'neginosai. It's the only time in the whole Tanakh where this word appears outside the Tehillim. What it means is as follows, that the prophet may be aware of the exigencies and of the vicissitudes of life and of all of the negativity he sees before him. But I know that it's coming from God. I know it's not just the fickle finger of fate, like the Greeks believed, that we're just acting out, we're just role-playing what's going on up there with the gods and the angels. No, we believe the opposite, by the way. We believe that the angels act out from a widow. Hashem tzilcho al yad yinecha. God is your shadow. You're not the shadow of some angel. Right? Just relegated to some fate of whatever the angels are doing up there. And there's nothing you can do about it. Right? You can try, but sorry, you're bent towards that fate. Right? So that's what makes Habakkuk end the book in rejoicing. That we are not resigned to any particular fate. And for that I say. Chapter 20 of Yirmiyahu, I conclude, because Habakkuk so requires Yirmiyahu to make sense at the end of his book. Chapter 20 of Yirmiyahu talks about Yirmiyahu's personal struggles. He starts off by saying, they smite me, they beat me, they put me in stocks, they throw me in jail, I am a mockery, they deride me, I'm the object of their constant derision. And then he says, but God is my champion. God is my strength. I sing praises to God. I rejoice in God. I know that He will take care of all my enemies. And then he says, curse the day I was born. Curse the man who told my father that he has a male child. Curse the midwife that didn't choke me right out of my mother's womb, that I should see such a miserable life and miserable day. What's going on with him? Is manic depression? Okay. He goes so quickly from one reader to another. By the way, if you read Eichel chapter 3, it's exactly what happens there. He's told the seesaw five times, back and forth, hope to despair. Now, Habakkuk ends on the hope. The book can't end with despair. It's not the end of your. The end is chapter 20. It's not the end of your Yah. But the book of Habakkuk ends on a profoundly high note of hope that this didn't happen to us because of an overwhelming force of Babylonian might that overcame a weaker Israelite army. That's not what it said. We didn't lose by a shame because an overwhelming force of Roman might beat a fractious Jewish nation. Why did we lose by a shame? Sinat chinam, baseless hatred. Really? That's what the Romans would write in their history books? We defeated the Jews because they were speaking Lashon Hara against each other? Is that realistic? Is that what an historian is going to write? Of course not. But the Bible is not a history book. The Bible is a moral code. The moral code says they can chain you to a slave ship and drive you to places all over the world. You will defeat those slave drivers because you are moral and they are not. Today, they have defeated you. But in the long run, you will defeat them. And that's something Habakkuk can sing about. Even though at the time he's singing, there's still the destruction before him. There's still in its Babylonian period right now. Right? But he's saying, I see that the war has turned. I see the tide has turned. I don't have the keys to the car, but I do have a sense that I'm alive and almost as important that I'll get to get the car back. Right? It's just that because the Jews didn't listen to Yirmiyahu the way they should have, the car didn't have so much gas in it. Yes?
Who would listen to Yirmiyahu? Why would anyone listen to Yirmiyahu?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's a medrash that says Yirmiyahu begged God, can't you give me like a staff like the one that Moshe had so that they can listen to me and I can show them some of your might and strength? Hashem answered, Moshe had one of those, right? But but it didn't help him so much. They still rejected him. So don't think that you're going to be accepted because of a staff. You give the word, you give the moral word. People cannot object to morality. They may object to your timing or whatever else that is going on in the world, but you speak the word, it'll have its lasting effect. And we still meet, of course it's Yirmiyahu, we mean Torah is from Yirmiyahu, and people named Yirmiyahu. Who's named Hanani ben Azur? You know, who's named, I guess Hanani has a name, but Hanani ben Azur was one of the false prophets who challenged him. But you're right, most people probably didn't listen to him. But the few thousand, you know, comprised those, the descendants comprised those 42,360 who came back. Some did. Okay, not enough. It would be better if more did. But enough did.
So if somebody came in and said, I have a message from God, America is one member, everyone has to rush to Israel. And then, you know, in 2,000 years, people will be reading about us, oh, why didn't they move to Israel?
Yeah, today it's a little different because we believe in the Shekhar Bismikish in a certain world, Khan Shotin. So someone who says, I speak a prophetic word, you know, people are always making predictions or suggestions of what we should be doing, right? And, you know, people who lived during World War II, they were Jewish leaders who were at great odds. What's better, to try to get on FDR's good side and help him win the war, or agitate more for the sake of Europeans, lost Jews? So you know, everyone is always making, and in retrospect, 67 years later, we hear people saying, you know, the Jews didn't do enough here, or things like that. So, okay, but someone who you know, we've had those disputes and arguments all the time about what's better to do for Israel. Should we support the president with his policies? Should we try to get from the inside? Should we agitate from the outside? You know, what got the Iron Curtain to fall down? Was it the agitators? Was it the people who were... And this is a discussion all along. Right? There were, maybe not enough, but there were people who heard Yirmiyahu's call. And I conclude by saying that if we think that Yirmiyahu's mission was to avoid the Churban and prevent the loss of the land, he was a profound failure. But what's more likely, and I think this is how we should approach Yirmiyahu, it's indispensable to understand Habakkuk Ter Gimel is to know what Yirmiyahu is about, and this nature of Yirmiyahu, is that Yirmiyahu's mission was not to save the kingdom. The kingdom was lost already. The boy's been driving the car in a bad way all along. Yirmiyahu's mission was to instill within the people the hope that 70 years later you will be able to come back. No, none of the other nations came back after the Babylonians dispersed them, or the Assyrians wiped them out. Okay? So, and there's every indication that was in the later books of the Tanakh. The spirit of Zechariah, of Haggai, of Ezra and Nehemiah was stirred in Daniel to actually make reference. They made specific reference to 70 years that Yirmiyahu said is now up, and some of them lost hope because they saw nothing's happening. Problem is that Yirmiyahu made two different predictions of 70-year levels. One from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, and one from the destruction of the Mikdash. Those 2 dates are 20 years apart. So when the first 70 years was over, and they didn't see anything positive happening in terms of their return, there was a widespread loss of hope. The prophet stepped in and said, no, he was that 7 years had to do with Babylon, not with us. Right? Okay, so in those terms, Yirmiyahu was a success. We did return, and when we returned, it was his name that was on the lips of the returnees. Okay, so ends Sefer Habakkuk with the hope that was realized years later. Okay, we're going to start Sfanya. Sfanya, make sure you bring your Sfarim. We're going to start Sfanya, Mitzvah Hashem, next class.